priest, dear friend, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. We are The Personal Wealth Coach, combined sort of as the two hosts of the parasitic arrangement. If you got, you know, have a host, you might as well have a parasite. This is The Personal Wealth Coach, and not coincidentally, The Personal Wealth Coach is also an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Now, that doesn't mean that the Securities and Exchange Commission has said anything good or bad about us, about the firm, The Personal Wealth Coach. They are just the folks that the firm is registered with. If you would like to complain to somebody, they're the people to complain about if we say something stupid. Well, not just stupid. Stupid and damaging. Well, you'd be complaining all day long if you just complained about stuff that we said that was stupid. You want to say the next bit about fiduciary stuff?
Well, the fiduciary stuff. I was going to talk about the radio station. We are fiduciary investment advisors, and fiduciary is a very important word. And fiduciary means that we operate in our client's best interest and don't have big conflicts of interest. The important thing is that we are not giving investment advice on this particular radio program. What we're giving is information and in education, which is a big different thing from fiduciary investment advice, because we don't know you individually. We can't give you individual advice, and therefore it's not advice.
Not on the radio anyway. Now, if you would like to call in and talk to us in person, not on the air, we would actually try customizing the advice. That's the difference between education and advice. There you go. You want to do the other one about the commercials now? You wanted to do that before.
Yeah, I did want to do that. We don't pay for this radio program, so it's not an infomercial. We do pay for advertising on KTEM, but the advertising we pay for on KTEM is for the radio program, so we go figure out that one. KTEM does not pay us to do the radio program either, so it's a public service that we do, and it's not an infomercial, although we do advertise for ourselves on the radio program, but the rest of the radio is not about coming to see us. It's about taking care of your own finances.
Good. Now, I think that's everything. Oh, wait, the information that we are talking about on here. Do you want to say that one? You like to say deem, and you like to say the others.
I'm going to say the lawyerly stuff now. The information we provide on this radio program is from sources we deem to be reliable, but is not warranted or guaranteed as to accuracy or completeness.
Woohoo!
Woo, wasn't that neat?
Yeah, we got all our disclosures out of the way. That was fantastic.
In record time.
Well, some kind of record. I don't know if it was a long record or a short record or the middle record. This is a record because we've never done our disclosures in exactly that time before. It isn't faster or slower necessarily. It's just the first time we've had it in that time.
Well, let's talk about the markets just a moment. We always lead off with that, so it's a good idea. The S&P 500 stock index, which we lovingly call the SPX, fell a whopping 5.64% for the week, which is a lot to fall in 1 week for an index or for anything else. It closed at 3269.96, which is puts it back down in the 3200 range, which is where it wandered around all summer. It's basically given up about 3 months of gains. It is well below where it was in September. It's about 8.7% down from its peak in September. And by the way, a correction technically occurs when the market drops 10% from a previous peak. And it's getting close, folks.
Yeah, we are so close. It's right on the edge of correction. We might get the final portion of the correction on Monday, or it might turn around and go the other direction.
Well, I think a good investment right now would be correction tape.
Yes, we need some correction tape immediately.
And there's going to be a lot of it because it's big market.
Yes. I've got it all over my computer screen. I need to get this stuff off.
I'm not even going to comment on that. The new surge in COVID-19 cases is probably the largest single effect. In case you hadn't noted, we had on Thursday like about 90,000 new cases, and that translates into about a week or two later, it translates into a lot of people in the hospital, and the hospital's overflowing, and governors getting scared and shutting down economies. And for some reason or another, the market said, whoops, here we go again, because we now have more COVID cases per day showing up than we did at the height back in July.
Yeah. And we're now at the height. We thought that the last height was the height, and before that we thought the height before that was the height, but now we're at this height, and this is how high we are.
And unlike the last one, when we had lots and lots of COVID cases and hospitals filling up and people being transferred to other hospitals, in this case we are very unlikely to get a federal stimulus in the short term, at least. The House of Representatives and the administration could not agree on how big to make the stimulus program, the support program, really,
more than specifically who to pay for it. The Democrats would really like some aid to the states. The administration wants it to go directly to families. And I think they both have some part of the truth, and the combined truth is that they're both right and they should get some for both. But
actually, the House bill that passed had both in there, but what the difference in size between the two of them is the administration doesn't want local communities and states to get any money at all. That's the difference between the $1.8 trillion. Ooh, big difference.
Million, trillion, just minor zeros and commas. No big deal.
Just a thousand times. $1.8 trillion is what the White House has offered, and
It's 100,000 times. 1,000 times would be a billion. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I said a million. Oh, yeah, that's right.
1,000 times, yeah.
A million times. Whoa. Anyway, the point is that the House of Representatives bill includes states and local communities because they're going to have to start laying off the important first responders. That's their argument. And the White House says no, because most of those communities that need the money are Democrats, so we're not going to give it to them.
Yeah, it's very political, as if everything wasn't. Wait a minute. In case you were been hiding under a rock, it seems that a lot of the decisions being made by Congress and the president at the moment are very political.
You think the place was full of politicians.
Or something like that. Right.
You think an election coming up or something, but, you know, clearly we're not having anything like that.
So what we're saying here is there may be something that comes out of the lame duck Congress, and we don't know if the administration is going to be a lame duck or not. There's always a lame duck Congress after the election. There's not always a lame duck presidency. If he's reelected, then he'll be working with a lame duck Congress. If he's not, then he'll be a lame duck president and have really nothing to lose either way. That's why
be a lame duck president working with a lame duck Congress, which means there'll be a lot of limping going on.
All right, let me explain what a lame duck is. This is something that I just think everybody knows what a lame duck is. A duck is a bird, and when it flies, it generally flies well. If it's having trouble flying, it's considered to be lame. When Congress goes through an election cycle, they know the results of the election after however many days, if there's recounts or whatever. And they know either they got elected or they got reelected or they didn't get reelected. The bottom line, though, is that it's going to be quite some time until the next election. And whatever they vote on now, they can cross party lines. They can make all kinds of deals. And they're not terrified that their base is not going to vote for them because they talked to someone of the opposite party, whether that be Democrat or Republican. The Republicans are like, well, my representative better not be talking to those Democrats. And of course, the Democrats are saying, well, my representative better not be talking to those Republicans. After the election, there's more talking that gets to take place because, believe it or not, a lot of those people in D.C. are actually there because they want to help, at least partially there, because they want to help the country. There may be some ego involved. I'm understating the issue here a little bit. There may be a little bit of ego involved in running for office, but at the end of the day, I think everybody really wants the country to do better. I hope, man, I hope. It's hard to see that sometimes. It's definitely, if you're really partisan, it's hard to see that about the other party. And that doesn't matter which party you are. So it kind of balances out. So that's where we are. In the lame duck, we may actually get some compromise. We may get a stimulus package coming out in November. I still doubt it, though. I still have a great deal of doubt that we're going to be there. It'd be nice. I think it's a necessary thing for the economy. I mean, we can do it without it, but it's going to take us longer to recover.
Let's talk a little more about the markets. The S&P 500 was down nearly 9%, obviously, and it is since its peak. And so it's coming close to correction. But the interesting thing is the bond market, represented by the 10-year Treasury note yield, moved in the other direction. It actually rose 5% to 0.879%, which is a very, very tiny percentage. It used to be pretty typical in my memory when a 10-year Treasury note would yield 6%. Pay 6% per year for 10 years to hold it, which I think is pretty reasonable, but that's my point of view. It's now down to 0.879%, nearly 0.9%. But that meant the yield curve was getting steeper. So we have these really, really low interest rates. And if you're trying to get any interest out of a CD or something like that at the bank, you've noticed that. But the yield curve is positive and getting more positive as time goes by. So that sends a signal. It's not a perfect forecast, but it's a good signal. And the signal is that we are going to be in recovery and in a much more healthy economy. That's what the bond market is saying. A year from now, or between a year and 18 months from now. It's also saying, though, that interest rates are going to remain fairly low in that period, which means demand for borrowed money won't be real high, which means that we'll have a recovery in a year or so, but it won't be really, really powerful. So that's a very important metric, which kind of rolls into the question we have out there. Oil, on the other hand, said, nope, we don't agree. The West Texas Intermediate crude dropped down to $35.59 per barrel, which meant oil companies are losing money. With fracking, oil companies are losing money for every barrel they pump out of the ground. They still keep pumping, by the way, because it gives them some cash flow. But it costs them more to bring that oil out of the ground than they're getting for it. The problem with this, the oil says, hey, an increase in COVID means a decrease in business and a decrease in travel. And by the way, there's a tight correlation there. The analysis have shown that. The higher the COVID infection rate gets, the slower the economy gets in local areas across the country.
Is that amazing or what? I mean, that's one of those common sense things. When a lot of people are sick, they tend to either, if they're healthy, not want to get sick, or they're going to stay home. Yeah.
But anyway, oil went down in price, and that's not a good thing. Oil is, in essence, forecasting, at this price, is forecasting another recession. And the bond market is saying, no, things in 12 to 18 months are going to be much better. And the stock market is saying, we are not anywhere near as optimistic as we used to be, but we're still really way up there in the sky. And we can talk about stocks some more later.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And we've got a ton of questions already. Well, three questions for us. That's a ton that are out there waiting.
We now have a new definition of a ton.
Yes. It's no longer measured in pounds or kilograms. It is now measured in emails.
Now, is it a short ton or a long ton?
It's a royal ton.
Oh, okay.
All right. So we've got some questions. Are we done with the market for now, or are we going to wrap up some more?
I want to talk about a little bit more about the fact that several people have come out now and acknowledged, hey, we may be seeing a bubble in the market. And we may be due for a correction. We may have already started into correction.
Yeah.
But
I agree. I think that is a good, pretty good long chunk of time to talk about. I think if we're not in a correction on Monday, I'd be a little bit surprised. Maybe Tuesday. It might turn around and go the other way. I mean, 10% is just an arbitrary number.
But what I wanted to talk about was the fact that normally the price-to-earnings ratio of the top 10 stocks, the largest 10 stocks in the S&P 500 historically, has been about the same as the S&P 500 in general.
Right.
Now, P/E ratio means the number of years earnings it would take to buy the stock. Right now, the price earnings ratio of the largest 10 stocks in the S&P 500 is 60% higher than the price earnings ratio of the rest of the S&P 500, which indicates that we're not in mania territory yet. We could conceivably get to mania territory, but we are definitely in bubble territory at this point. It's just historically, when the top 10 stocks, no matter how good they look at that given moment, are this far above where they should, the rest of the S&P 500, there's at some point a correction coming, and I think we got one coming. We may be in the early stages of a correction right now. Do I think we're going to have a stock market crash where we drop 50% and stay there for some time? Nah, I don't think so. I think we've just gotten ahead of ourselves, which is what corrections are all about. Corrections, we call these healthy corrections when we get a dip in the market like this. Doesn't feel very healthy, but it really is.
Yeah, we've been talking about the big chunk of the market is way overpriced for a while, and it still is, even after we've had the drop of the past month. All right, so let's hit some questions, and we'll come back to corrections and what they could mean and where we think the market's going after. Because I think this first question for sure hits right on the nail what we would be talking about when it came to the market anyway. John sends an email. It says, of all the financial metrics out there that we're bombarded with, is there one that's a more important indicator of the economy from an investment standpoint? Yeah. Yes, there is. That indicator is 100% personal, and it has to do with your time frame. From an investment standpoint, there is one indicator, and it has to do with your planning. It is by far the most important indicator out there. It has to do with what you're planning to do with your investments. If you have a planned goal of paying off your house using your portfolio money, which may or may not be a good idea, generally not, but not always a bad idea. That's going to affect your portfolio value a lot. It will also affect your long-term planning on that portfolio value. So I realize that's kind of a trick answer, because he says of all these things that we're bombarded with, what's the most important? It's the real answer, though. There's a lot of macro numbers out there that are talking in aggregate. The average of all of this stuff out there in the world or in the country or in a state or even in a metropolitan area that you happen to live in, that might be important. But the reality is that your decision-making process for you, if you find out that you're getting laid off, that's a much more important indicator for your own investment portfolio than other areas. Now, we like to look at the leading indicators. We think, and there's a changing number, but it runs between 10 and 13 numbers of leading indicators that hang out there. Sometimes it gets lower than that. And what are we at now? Like 8 leading indicators?
Something like that, right?
Yeah. And it kind of fluctuates how many are in the pool of leading indicators. We like to watch that because it tells us what's coming more than looking at the lagging indicators or the concurrent indicators. So a lagging indicator would be like labor. The number of people getting laid off this week are because of hurts in a business that have already happened. And I realize that there is this concept of corporations that say, hey, we may not make money next quarter, let's lay off all our employees. But the reality is that's not the way corporations work. It's not the way humans work. You wait till you've got less money before you stop paying it out. Otherwise, we didn't maybe have more money around, but the reality is that labor, you hire not before you think you're going to be making more money, but after you're making more money, when you're going, whoa, I can't keep up with the demand anymore. I got to hire somebody. And you drop somebody off your labor force when you say, hey, we don't have enough money to go around. The demand is just not there. We've got too many people. And I think that is from a lagging indicator perspective, it's important to know it because it kind of confirms the leading indicators from months ago, and it confirms the concurrent indicators from the week before. Concurrent would be stuff that we can see right now, like new jobs coming in are going to be concurrent and slightly lagging, because they'll be saying we've got some profitability and we expect a little bit more. We expect right now to have more profitability. That's what we look. I mean, there's a lot of indicators. What would you say? What would you say would be the most important?
I would say that it depends on whether you're looking long-term or short-term. Short-term, there's a lot of variance out there. In the economy, labor is the number of people employed is critical. When you don't, when you have unemployment, and we realize that the technical unemployment number means one thing and the real unemployment number means another. But when you have 20 million people drawing unemployment, there's no way we're going to get back to a healthy economy very quickly.
Right. Yep. So, go ahead.
The other indicator, the longer-term indicator, which is, I think, more important for an investor, is looking at that yield curve. If you've got a good steep yield curve, be optimistic and say, yeah, that's pretty cool. And we can, you know, that's not a 100% accurate forecast. But for example, last year, during the summer and into the fall, and even into the spring, we had an inverted yield curve. We had this big dip in the yield curve where the collective wisdom of all those people buying and selling U.S. treasuries was we're headed for a recession. And they didn't even realize that that was a collective wisdom. They just looked at what they thought interest rates were going to be in the future and made their purchases or their sales based on that. And they were amazingly correct. I mean, there's no way in the world they could have forecast the COVID-19 crisis coming. But collectively, they said, we're due for a recession. And we got a recession. We got a big one. And you go back and look through the modern history of the bond market, the modern history of our economy post-World War II, and the leading economic indicators have been really, really good at forecasting a down market, a down economy coming. Matter of fact, the only problem with the leading economic indicators is one of them, yield curve, by the way, is one of them. One of the major leading economic indicators is the stock market. Right. So the stock has to go down before it forecasts the stock market going down.
He wasn't talking about the stock market, though. He said the economy. So it's fine. So it is a leading indicator for the economy. It's just not always correct. It forecasts about 12 of 8 recessions. So it's wrong about a third of the time. When it goes down, it may not mean that the economy is going to follow. But a lot of times when it goes down, it means the economy follows. But back to the question, the reason why we're hemming and hawing and talking about all these crazy important indicators is it's very much like going to a doctor and saying, I've got all these test results. Tell me, what's the most important one on here for my overall health? And the doctor says, well, it depends on what's wrong with you.
The answer is yes.
Exactly. Because they're all meant to diagnose things that could be major problems or could be major benefits, and they become more important the bigger the benefit or bigger the problem. So that is our – I came back to the trick answer again. It depends on the individual. It really does.
Actually, you can just simply say it all depends.
Yeah. On the other hand – FDR said, what I want is a two-handed or a one-handed economist. Yeah, we're never going to get pinned down to saying this is the most important thing on the economy. It'd be like the doctor saying, the most important test you can get is your body mass index. If there are three other doctors in the room, you're going to get 12 other opinions. And that's the truth. The same with economists.
Reminds me of the guy who said, I want a second opinion. The doctor responded, yeah, and you're fat, too.
Yeah,
we got another question from John about the bill that, by the way, has no chance of passing in this Congress.
Right.
On retirement savings. It's bipartisan, and hopefully in the next Congress, whoever gets elected and whatever majorities we have, it'll still pass. It basically is a good bill. His question was, which plan do you feel is better for the investor? Is he one of what was it, Neil Brady or Biden plan?
Yeah.
I don't know that the Biden plan is any. Biden has not specified a specific plan for retirement that I know of.
No, he's mentioned some things about, yes, about how much goes into a 401k and what percentage is deductible of what goes into a 401k, but they're not comparable plans. I suspect if the Neil Brady bill were set up pretty much the way it is, either candidate for president would probably be okay with it.
Well, actually, I think that the if you combine the two of them, you've got something going. The Neil Brady bill makes it easier to get to give you more money that you can contribute to the 401k. And it enables you to wait till 75 to start taking required minimum distributions, but they'll be bigger. It makes people who have lost 401ks, and believe me, there's a lot of them, they're going to think this is crazy. A lot of people, when they leave their work, the last thing on their mind is thinking about is their 401k. Well, at some point, the 401k, I mean, it sits there for a certain period of time, and if it doesn't get answered, it goes to the state.
Well, it can. And most 401ks are going to be, if you've got a balance less than $5,000 and you don't claim it after 3 or 4 years, they're either going to send you a check or they're going to hand it over to the state and hope that you find it sometime. Eventually, the state gets to spend it if you haven't collected it from the state for long enough. That's called escheating, by the way. And it's, when you talk about escheating your assets, don't escheat your assets.
Yes, it sounds like a sneeze too.
Yeah.
But the bill, the Biden bill, has basically says if you're lower income, it boils down to the fact if you're a higher income person, you can easily get a 26% deduction for putting money into 401k.
If you're in the top, you could get a 37% deduction as things stand.
But the average in the upper income is around 26%. So what the Biden bill says, if you would get less than 26%, in essence, money that you don't have to pay the government, then the government would go ahead and put that money in there anyway. So a person in the lower income brackets, the people who need the 401k generally the most, would basically get a 26% match from the federal government. That's the Biden plan.
Right. So some combination of that is nice, but I suspect it's a good idea if you're going to match somebody's 401k from the government, there would need to be a concurrent cut to Social Security for that same person.
Why?
Because where is the government going to get that money to match? We're running out of money in the Social Security Trust Fund. So if we go back to what the military did, what the federal government did for military and civilian employees, but more specifically to the military employees, is they had a straight pension plan. You work 20 years for us, you get a pension the rest of your life, and it's based on your top three earnings, and you can go on about that. It's a military retirement, and a lot of people are familiar with that.
Well, they still get Social Security, though.
Right, they still get Social. We're not touching on that. The money that was going to fund that plan for their pension technically was coming from the employee, and that the government was supposed to be pulling it out of their money, and you could see it on your LES. There it goes. It's coming out of my money. It's going to a pension. There's a new plan in place, and it's been there for, 6 years now? That includes a matching contribution to your TSP. And if you take the matching contribution to your TSP, you lose some of your pension benefit. You get a fixed benefit on your pension, and you get a variable benefit on your TSP, which is sort of, it's a thrift savings plan. It's similar to a 401k or a 403b, for those of you that aren't military or government. And I think it was a very well put together plan, and it was really not done by any executive administration level. It was done internally in the TSP and in the military to say, all right, we're going to put some Roth availability in your TSP. You're going to get to decide if you put money in here, we can match you up to this amount. But if you choose this match, you're going to lose some of the pension over here. And you got to make that election which way you went. If you were in the military already and been there for long enough, you didn't get the choice. You get the pension. If you were in early or if recently enough, you get to make this choice. And I think the same thing should be done. If the government is going to match a 401k, where does the money come from? And Social Security is already breaking. If we take some of the money from Social Security to do this match, or some of the money from the general fund, when we've got a $3 trillion extra debt this year alone, at some point we're just adding to future problems.
Well, the argument is, and I think it's a good argument, is that a lot of people are already getting a whole bunch of deductions. They're getting a federal benefit, in other words, for investing in a 401k, and they pay it back when they take the money out. And doing the same thing for people in lower income tax brackets and giving them the same benefit or the average benefit would cause them to be more likely to put their money into a 401k.
Which
I think is a very positive thing, because we have a crisis coming. It's already to some small degree upon us, but we have a crisis coming in retirement. Let's just say, and this is hypothetical, obviously, that Social Security runs out of money in a few years, which it supposed to do according to the trustees.
Yeah, the trustees, before the pandemic hit, said 2035. The preponderance of economists, including us, say after the pandemic, it's likely 2030. That's 10 years out before the trust fund runs out of money. What happens then? They cut your benefit by about a third. That's it. They don't cut it off completely.
I heard it was 20%, but that's all right. Maybe it is a third.
It's by about a third because it's based on what revenue is being received at that point. If it happened today, it would be 20%.
So there are going to be people who are largely dependent upon Social Security who are going to have 20% or 30% less money coming in each month than they planned on. Well, they're probably not planning on anything. They're just going to get it. And we're going to run into a problem where we have the same thing that created Social Security. You have older people who literally are starving if we don't do something. And we got to do something, and we got to do it preferably now. And I think encouraging more people to use a 401k is a step in the right direction.
I think
that the condition that should be put on the 401k is if you take the 26% matching from the government, you don't get to take it out until you retire. And you only get to take it out in monthly increments. You can't. When you leave your job, you can't take it and pay a 20% tax penalty.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think that if you're getting an extra benefit for it, it should be set. This is your retirement for real. You're getting an extra retirement benefit here. It's retirement.
One of the problems with the 401k, and I realize a lot of people don't think it's a problem, but it's a major problem, is particularly lower income people, when they leave their job or they get laid off or whatever, the 401k, they have a choice. They have a choice of either taking all the money in the 401k and paying a 20% tax penalty in addition to regular income taxes, or leaving it in there or rolling it over to an IRA. And unfortunately, the lower a person's income is, the more likely they are to take the lump sum. I mean, they just lost their job.
Yeah.
And that's a reasonable response to losing their job. They could probably survive without the 401k money. And then they spend all the 401k money. And here's where it really gets interesting. If come April 15th or come October or whatever, the following year, and they file their income taxes or don't file their income taxes, the IRS says, okay, we want a whole bunch of money from you and you're flat broke.
Yeah.
And then they're really in a world of hurt.
And this is, this kind of segues. We got another question here, and I'll touch on that in just a moment. One of the executive orders that the president did with great intent was the payroll tax holiday for the end of the year going into next year. He said, if your employer agrees to it, you can keep part of the amount that you would be paying into Social Security. You get to keep it. The reason why it's not been picked up by a great deal of corporations is that if you leave the corporation, they either have to take that out of your last paycheck. And if, say, you work to your last paycheck, and they don't know you're leaving, then they have to come up with that money out of their own pocket that they've already paid to you that they have to pay to the government as well. Go ahead.
One of the problems with that, with the executive order, it really wasn't a grant. It was a loan.
Yeah, you got to pay it back next year.
So next year, which when we still could be in a COVID crisis, and it looks like we will be in a COVID crisis, all the Social Security and FICA, all the FICA that you didn't pay,
comes out of your paycheck.
And I don't know. I'm not forecasting the future, but I can tell you historically, pandemics, the second wave is worse than the first wave, and we're, I think, in the second wave, and it is worse than the first wave. And the third wave is worse than the first or the second wave. So we could be in a real world of hurt just about the time that the government says, okay, we want that money back.
Right. Now, I've got another question here from Linda. She said, I just checked into refinancing my homestead. We owe, or I owe, it just says owe, $67,000. Sent info to the credit union, and they want over $9,000 for a VA loan, which, of course, we will not do. Is that the norm for a refinance? No. Answer to that question very easily is no. It is a very strange time right now for refinancing. If you talk to three different banks, you're going to get wildly different estimates on cost because there is no normalcy. It depends on where the money is coming from. With a VA loan, we know where the money's coming from. It's coming from Ginnie Mae, Government National Mortgage Association. What's that?
You're right.
The Government National Mortgage Association is what buys up the VA loans, and they do it because it's a VA loan. They also do low-cost housing, that sort of thing, but the biggest part of Ginnie Mae's is the VA loan. That makes it extremely easy for the originating bank or credit union.
The loan arranger.
Yeah, the loan arranger. That entity has to have money on hand. And if they're short of money on hand for whatever reason, their fees are going to be higher. Isn't that amazing? It's like if they don't have money, they want more.
While we're at it, since you've answered your question, you can contact us at either jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. I don't think we gave that out.
I'm going to give some free advertising for a VA mortgage company, or you can.
USA Today.
That is a news organization.
No, New Day USA. That's
New Day
it.
USA. Okay.
Too many news sites. They've done a one. I will just simply say they did a wonderful job. I'm a veteran, and they refinanced my mortgage. And yeah, it did cost about 2%, which is the standard in the industry.
So a 2% of $67,000 is not a lot of money. It's certainly not $9,000. Now, that $9,000, some of that might be title fee. Some of that. The reality, though, is if you already have a VA loan and you're refinancing a VA loan, they rarely do a title check because it's the VA that holds it or the Ginnie Mae that holds it.
Well, actually, they did a title check on mine. They did it all, but that was in that second 1%. So it was 1% that there's a VA origination fee that goes to the government. And there's another 1% generally charged by the loan arranger. And I call them that because it was in a cartoon a long time ago.
Right. So if you've got if this is your first time doing it, and you can go to the va.gov, housing assistance, home loans, funding fee and closing costs. You just look for VA closing costs from the va.gov. And you'll see that if you've already had a VA loan in your life, this is going to be after your first use, and you've got more than a 10% down payment, I'm going to assume you have more than a 10%. You didn't say what the value of your house was. You say you owe $67,000, but not very many houses are in this area for $67,000. I assume you've got a more than a 10% down payment. That means your VA funding fee should be about 1.4%. Not about. That's what it says on the chart. 1.4%. Now you still have some title fees and so on. If you were getting cash back out, it would be more like 3.6% rather than 1.4%. But the reality is that that's too much. The closing costs on the bank end were higher than the VA costs. So I would highly recommend you go and check with somebody else, because you'll save some money. And $9,000, how long would it take you to pay back a $9,000 cost? How much savings would you have per month to pay that back in a reasonable period of time? Your payment on your house, I doubt, is in the thousands of dollars a month when you're owing $67,000, which means it would take you a long time to have that paid back. It may be your current loan was less expensive than the new one at that fee. Go ahead.
I'll also suggest you just Google New Day USA and call them and say, what would you charge me to do a VA loan?
Right.
I'll give you a pretty quick answer.
Could you say the name of the company again, but not the news organization? Because you just said it wrong again.
New Day USA.
There you go. New Day USA.
New Day USA. I'm sorry.
It's all right. We got another question.
They both got USA in them.
Right.
Go ahead.
Lots of ads about negotiating down the amount you owe credit card companies. Sounds too good to be true. What's the catch? Your credit rating.
First, you have to be in a position where you can't pay your loan. We can't pay your credit card bills. You have to be coasting on the edge of bankruptcy. And secondly, if you don't pay those credit card bills and they get written down, for 7 years, it's going to be rough for you to get a decent credit card or a decent borrow money anywhere.
Yeah. Your credit score will go down if you've negotiated with the credit company to pay less than you owe them. That is the catch. Sometimes it is still absolutely the best deal. But probably the program that comes on before us, Ask a Lawyer, deals with bankruptcy quite graphically. Ed's been doing bankruptcy law for 9 or 10 centuries. So he's got a compendium of data there. And sometimes bankruptcy is better than negotiating the credit card. You're going to need to talk to a bankruptcy attorney about that if you need it. But you obviously know what the catch is in a bankruptcy, because it's going to make a black mark on your credit record. Well, so does negotiating with a credit company. It's maybe not as big a black mark, but if you have to do it with a lot of places, one big black mark is lots better than lots of little black marks. And we've got to play some commercials. Whoa, got late in the hour all of a sudden. How did that happen?
And we didn't even get a chance to talk about the big news.
Right. We'll be coming back on the other side of these commercials with more of the big news. I'll give the email addresses one more time, which are Jeff@tpwc.com, as in thepersonalwealthcoach.com, or Jake@tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side after these, I'm sure, extremely important commercials. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff.
We're both McClures.
I think so.
Yeah, normally we would try to say our last name together, but during the pandemic, we've been out of sync because we're out of sync in time and place. He's in Salado. I'm in Salado. The studio's in Temple, but we're not in the same place in Salado. So this is like a three-way call, and my mom might pick up the line at some point and start dialing out to talk to somebody. How's that?
Yeah.
That dated me. I think a lot of people just got an image of a 42-foot-long telephone coiled cord that was tangled around their finger as they were lying on the ground talking to the phone.
We're not really in the KTM studios. We're digitally in the KTM studios, and we're protected from virus infections by our antivirus software.
Yes. I was going in every week for a long, long time and spraying things down. And the board at the studio has labels all over it, little tape with written labels on them. But between all of the people that sit at that desk and spray it down, those labels are now mostly blank. So we don't know what anything does anymore except by memory. This is going to be fun when we go back to being in person in the studio, but that may be another 6 months. or longer.
Well, that raises another issue. We want to get onto the GDP, but I think it's going to be next hour. It's really important that we talk about the GDP report, the record 33.1% growth in GDP that really wasn't a 33.1% growth. It was really like a 7.4% growth, and we can explain that. But we also want to talk about something that's very, very critical, and I hope we hit it both hours, and that is the COVID spread in the United States. Texas is once again racing towards first place in COVID virus infections. The COVID disease is spreading at 10.5%. Get this again. I want you to hang on to your hats. 10.5% per day in the state of Texas, at least it was towards the end of this week. That is an astonishing number. The official number, I think, for yesterday in the United States was 99,000 new COVID cases yesterday alone, which is just 74,000 was the highest, around 70,000 was the highest we hit in July, and we're now up to 99,000. We're breaking records for hospitalizations again. And in parts of Texas, people are setting up, well, in Austin is setting up its convention center again.
Yeah, the active cases are estimated at about 101,000. That's from the state of Texas's dashboard. They're the ones that, I mean, this is the state government that's put this together. And it's 101,000 active cases right now. We've had confirmed about 900,000 during the entire pandemic. So that includes our peak time back in July as well. July through August, we were number one. So just know that we're heading back up there. Although if you look at per 100,000 people, North Dakota has everybody beat hands down. They are.
Yeah. Both people in North Dakota now have COVID virus.
Right. And that's the one congressman and both senators. That's the only people in the state, but
yeah,
no, that's rather rude. It's a beautiful place.
Beautiful place. There's not very many people there. The reason I say that is it's important, and I just had a personal friend who I also have a professional relationship with who came down with COVID, and he's a young man, and he's very, very healthy, and he is one sick puppy, let me tell you. He looks terrible. He sounds terrible. I saw him. I didn't see him personally. I saw him over the computer. But I can tell you that the virus is spreading very, very fast. We're up to 100 deaths in Bell County, and it is accelerating here in Texas. Just because the epicenter is no longer Houston, it's El Paso, doesn't mean the epicenter won't move someplace else and is moving someplace else. One of the things we're learning from the coronavirus right now is that the areas that didn't get hit very hard through down the middle of the country are the places it's coming back to with a sledgehammer. And it is, here, an epidemiologist from the World Health Organization this morning I was listening to on the radio, who said it's accelerating in the United States. It's not decelerating. It's not flat. The rate of infection is accelerating. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the weather's gotten colder. People are moving inside. And we have coronavirus fatigue. People are just not wearing masks as much as they used to. I've seen several people in the past few days who came to the house for various reasons or came near the house who simply didn't have a mask. And that is critically dangerous. If that person is breathing and talking,